You're listening to Foresight, a podcast about making work better. I'm your co-host, Mark Edgar, a former consultant and coach who now works as a chief people officer on a mission to make work more human.
And I'm Naomi Teitelman, a former big firm consultant and HR executive, now striving to make work better one organization and one leader at a time. Every week, we'll discuss the latest trends that are impacting the new world of work to help you be a better leader for the future. Welcome to Foresight, a podcast about making work better. I'm one of your co-hosts, Naomi Teitelman, and I'm very excited to welcome today's special guest, Josh Burson, back to the show. Josh needs little introduction. He is a LinkedIn influencer with now over 900,000 followers. I think that number goes up by about 50 to 100,000 each time we meet Josh. And you're also cited as one of the leading HR and workplace industry analysts in the world. Josh is regularly featured in many top talent and business publications, and his book Irresistible has become a go-to guide for organizations striving to become more employee-centered. Josh, you are officially the first of our guests who's been on our show a second time. Can you believe it was almost exactly a year ago to the day when we first welcomed you to Foresight? It was episode 17, and now we are in the 60s.
Wow. Naomi, thank you for inviting me back.
It's so great to have you. And in fact, when we last met, you had just taken on a very critical new role as grandfather. So Teddy must have just turned one recently. How's it going? And how are you today, Josh?
Teddy's very good for a little one-year-old. He's having a ball. He's a very happy little boy. And I'm doing great too. A year later, life goes on. So things have changed, as you know.
Yeah. Lots has changed. And we're going to talk about all that's changed on the work front. But great to hear that grandfathering is going well and Teddy is thriving at 1 year old. And it's just fabulous to have you back on the show. So you, Josh, were first introduced to our Future Forward community as our keynote speaker at our second annual CHRO conference in 2017. And we've been very lucky to have had several visits from you ever since. So thank you for being a friend and supporter of Future Forward and welcome to Foresight.
Thank you, Naomi. Anytime I can come up there, I will. So you just let me know the next time and I'll be there.
Okay, great. Although we just talked about how travel is not is not so easy on the body.
I've had enough Vegas for a while, but I know many more trips to Vegas already coming.
Yeah, Toronto is a little bit more chill. So we promise to not give you the Vegas experience. We may not have the hoopla and party, but we're pretty nice people over here. So we'll have you here anytime. Well, I'm really excited to catch up today. We were supposed to record today's podcast on the scene at Transform in Vegas, where I was to be representing Future Forward as an official partner. And you, of course, Josh, delivered the keynote presentation. But you know what they say, you plan and life happens. So I missed out on your keynote at Transform, and I'm really eager to hear all about the Josh Burson Company's new AI HR assistant, Galileo, and your latest insights on trends impacting our world of work. So let's get into it.
Sounds good.
But before we do, because you are a Foresight pro, you know that we first start with a check-in question. So my check-in question today is, how are you experimenting with AI in your day-to-day?
I'm not just experimenting with it. I'm using it all constantly. Mm. I mean, when I write, you're doing a podcast right now. When I do podcasts, I upload them into Galileo to summarize them so I can recap what I wrote about, what I talked about. I use AI to search for information on the web. I use Perplexity. I use Gemini. I use ChatGPT. I use Galileo a lot. I use AI to analyze information about companies when I want to look at revenue or growth or number of employees. I use it to write articles or get articles started. I mean, we're just barely beginning to use. So it's going to be just a daily part of your life.
Yeah, amazing. Well, you're way ahead of me. I stop at your first point. I don't use Otter while I'm interviewing someone or when I'm talking to someone, but I do upload my recording into Otter and then I have ChatGPT kind of summarize it as a good place to start as my blog. But we will get into Galileo in a minute. I'd love to hear Galileo's capability and what the possibilities are for HR for sure. Before we go there, let's go back a year for a moment. What a year it's been. Last time we talked, you had just released Irresistible, which for our listeners, just a reminder, it shares 7 secrets of the world's most enduring employee-focused organizations. So what are you seeing, Josh, are the major shifts that you've seen in any of the 7 areas over the past year?
The big topic that I think the overwhelming sort of umbrella topic is that the workforce itself, not the companies that live in the workforce, but the workforce itself as a whole, has become far more dynamic, younger, demanding, empowered, and vocal than we ever could have expected. You know, from an employer standpoint, there's a real shortage of workers and there's a shortage of skills, and there's going to continue to be an increasing shortage. But, you know, if you think about what's going on in, if you have children, I have children in their 30s, the largest cohort of workers in the United States now is the age of 32 to 33. That is the number one largest segment of the workforce. These are people that are roughly, you know, 10 to 12 years out of college. They're trying to buy homes. They have postponed getting married. They're not having children. They're experimenting with psychedelic drugs. They might smoke marijuana. They're influencers. They're making money on the side, doing stuff on YouTube or TikTok. Yeah. I mean, their life is so different than the typical employee that, you know, I was in 1978 when I graduated from work, that companies have to, you know, kind of really rethink the hiring and management and pay and career practices that we have to address this, you know, much more dynamic workforce. And they're very vocal and empowered. You know, a lot of the research that just came out from Gallup and Edelman shows that the typical younger employee today expects the company to adapt to them. They don't want to adapt to the company. So they're saying, you know, if you can't meet my needs, my flexibility requirements, you know, my, you know, work styles, either I'm going to speak up or I'm not going to work here. And it's just completely different. So I can talk about all sorts of other things, but this is part of the post-industrial age, is dealing with a workforce that is just radically different than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds like a really difficult promise to deliver an irresistible organization, because irresistible doesn't mean the same thing to even two people sitting next to each other.
Well, you know, I mean, I think if you read through the book, the fundamental principles of the book absolutely apply. You have to listen, you have to coach people, you have to adapt to employee needs. I mean, one of the big things we just discovered in the research we just did, Naomi, on dynamic organizations, is if you think about the way companies used to innovate in the past, there are a lot of their good ideas and innovations would either come from the research department or from some very senior group in product or marketing that had, you know, kind of figured something out. Now, a lot of the really good ideas about what we need to do come from the front line, from the employees that are talking to customers all day. So one of the management principles, you know, in the book talks about listening to employees and coaching employees and creating open systems for feedback. That's the way you deal with these changes, is, you know, we can't sit around in an ivory tower and sort of make everybody do what we think they're going to do. They're going to tell us what they need. So that's all covered really in the concepts of irresistible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the hyper-personalization of the employee experience is enabled through technology, but there's a real human element that needs to be developed in our managers and leaders in order to even know how to hyper-personalize the experience.
Well, and it's actually very philosophically grounded too. So we have the CHRO of Marriott coming to the conference this year, and I talked to him about this. And during the early days of the pandemic, Marriott has, you know, I don't know, something like 1 million employees. I mean, just a huge footprint of real estate all over the world. So when the pandemic, you know, first hit, they were in complete shock. Mm-hmm. All of this real estate, no one can come in. No one wants to come in. The entire business looked like it was going to disappear. And one of the, I won't go through the whole story, but one of the revelations they came to was all of the good ideas on how to manage Marriott during the pandemic were going to come from the people in the properties running the local Marriott facilities and operations. And their management strategy or leadership strategy at the time was fairly top down. It was more traditional. And so they built a whole program to teach and encourage everybody at the line level, including people that do, you know, cleaning of rooms and, you know, local people working in the various hotels, to take action locally and to act as a leader. And what does it mean to be a leader during this transformational period? he pretty much explained to me the whole story, but they credit that with turning around Marriott during that period. And if you look at Marriott's stock since then, it's been just skyrocketing. They're doing so well, it's unbelievable. And that inversion of the management philosophy, he believes, and it makes perfect sense to me, is the reason that they turned that company around so quickly during the pandemic. So it's not just, you know, kind of like hippy-dippy software companies. This is everybody.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That's a great example. And, you know, we all have to turn management and leadership on its ear because we have, you know, generations coming into the workforce who know a lot more about the things that are going to drive our business forward than we do. You know, technology is a great example. You seem to be, you know, ahead of the game on your experimentation journey with AI, but, you know, many of our peers are not. So we really need to take those ideas from all levels of the organization and really facilitate an infrastructure that's conducive to doing that at scale. So really interesting times. The other thing that you've been tracking for a while, but just popped up in my inbox today is prediction number 7, which I'm not sure if you know the numbering of your predictions, but about HR getting pragmatic about the skills-based organization. So another thing that we have to kind of turn on its ear, and I think, you know, our peers are a little bit hesitant in terms of what does that actually mean? How can I actually put that into practice? And you articulated that so well in today's newsletter, but wondering if you could talk a little bit about more about that trend and what you're predicting there.
Yeah, and I don't want to get in trouble, but I'll be as honest as I can. I think we've totally gone a little haywire with the skills stuff.
Hmm.
And I have a whole story on this, but let me just take 2 minutes and try to explain. So the reason we started this whole concept of the skills-based organization, skills-based hiring, skills-based careers, skills-based jobs, really goes back to the older concepts of competency management. And competencies were fairly complex capabilities that were attached to job descriptions and job titles. So in the old world, the pre-industrial world or the industrial world, everything revolved around jobs. Now everything revolves around people. The people is the unit of activity, not the job. And so we want to affiliate or associate skills to people. Now, there's thousands and thousands of skills that everybody has. Maybe it's tens of thousands, depending on how you define what a skill is.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was the recruiting vendors initially and some of the LXP vendors realized that if we tag the words that correlate an individual's background to what we consider to be the job position or the job responsibility, we can use AI to match an individual to a role. And that matching approach, we can call it a skill. It isn't really a skill. It's a token. It's a series of words or letters that seem to match.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, you look at what those things are. They talk about things that sort of sound like skills. So, you know, this got turned into a whole initiative of technologies, you know, dozens and dozens of companies. And so now most of the bigger companies we talk to are trying to build skills-based strategies. What we basically have learned, though, after talking to literally hundreds of companies about this, is that, you know, implementing this as an infrastructure is kind of a waste of time.
Mm.
You really need to think of it as a solution to a problem. Skills is not a solution to a problem. Skills is not a solution. Skills is a piece of building a solution. So the really powerful skills strategies today are being very pragmatic, as we talk about in the report, about how do I apply skills towards hiring better scientists? If I'm a pharmaceutical company, how do I apply skills towards hiring better energy engineers? If I'm an oil company, how do I apply skills towards hiring data scientists or whatever it may be? Or developing a new expertise we need in alternative energy or in customer service or customer intimacy. Sitting around and building a skills taxonomy and then turning it on and hoping everything's going to get better doesn't work. It's too complex. So that's what this is about, is getting much more pragmatic. We've been doing workshops with companies about this. And when you get a group of HR people together with their business counterparts and you talk about these various business initiatives, all of a sudden it becomes very clear what the skills strategy should be. A really good example is we have one of the leaders of Coca-Cola coming to the conference. And what they did is they had a series of business meetings over the last year to look at the 4 major functional areas of growth that they need to be capable at in order to continue to grow over the years. I won't go through what they all are. And then they decompose that into around 100 skills that are, you know, fulfill these four major areas. So there's sort of 25 skills per area. Then they said, okay, each employee needs to have 3 to 5 skills. Now that is completely different from this idea of clicking a bunch of buttons and saying, let's see how many skills I can associate with myself. And what they're doing is they're being very pragmatic. They're just saying, look, we don't need to tell you to do everything. There's 3 or 4 things that really matter in the role you're in. We're going to help you decide what those are. We're going to build development programs and other things around it. And they're going to be aligned with the 4 major capability areas of this company. That's the way to do this, is to, is to be pragmatic about it.
Yeah, it makes total sense. Because the worry I had was, you know, when you're building these skills taxonomies, it's very subjective in terms of what you associate with what, right? Like communication, is it communication? Is it presentation skills? Is it executive presence, right? What do those things mean in general, in my company, as a capability that we need? So it sounds like, you know, we've experimented with a bunch of things in this space, and now it's really getting into, okay, what's a useful and pragmatic way to build a skills-based organization and to actually execute on it and make it sustainable?
Exactly. And you have to assume that whatever the taxonomy is you end up coming up with, if it isn't very, very, very business relevant, it's going to get out of control very fast.
Yeah.
Because every domain of business is changing. So, you know, the skills of pick your job, functional marketing, finance, HR, technology, engineering, they're changing like, you know, every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And the meaning of them changes every day, quite honestly. Business acumen 30 years ago is very different than business acumen now, right? From an HR perspective.
Right.
So that all makes perfect sense. The other trend that you've raised recently was around talent density. So that's a new one to me.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear more about what that means.
Okay. So this is a really big deal. So I'll spend a few minutes. There's a pretty long article I wrote on it, probably a little too long. But so generally speaking, everybody knows that the higher performing people you have in the company, the better success you're going to have. And today, while the labor market gets more and more competitive and companies get more focused on future skilling and transformation, this has become sort of a critical issue. So how do we, you know, assess and develop and hire the best possible skilled, aligned, ambitious people for our company? And that's different for every company, right? Somebody who's going to work out really well at company A isn't going to be a good fit at company B. Traditionally, when you're a small company, you do this by only hiring the people you need because you don't have a lot of money. So you're very, very selective. But as the company grows and you start to get middle managers, you get this bell curve effect. And the bell curve, or the normal curve, the normal distribution, is pretty much the fundamental idea behind performance management. That we're going to have 10% of the people that are 2 standard deviations to the right, 10% of the people that are 2 standard deviations to the left. We'll hyper promote the people on the right. We'll get rid of the people on the left. And we'll do that every year and continue to weed out the low performers. Sounds good, but what it basically does is it creates mediocrity. You're guaranteed now that 2/3 of your employees are in the middle of that curve. They're going to be rated at 2 or a 3. I know if you're rated at 2 and you're actually performing at a 3, you're thrilled. If you're rated at 2 and you're actually performing at a 1, you're ready to quit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the ratings really get in the way of promoting high performance, because what you really want is you want everybody to be a high performer. And let's not assume that 90% of the people are going to be substandard just because there's some bell curve floating around here that somebody applied to some other form of science.
Yeah.
It's not the way we want to look. That is what talent density is. Now, if you look at the definition, it really started with Netflix. The way you do this is you have to hire people very, very differently. In a traditional company, most companies, hiring's done by managers or supervisors, and the managers are hiring to fill slots. So I get a headcount from the, you know, CFO. Oh, great. I can hire another research analyst. I can hire another salesperson. Let's open up a position, decide what the responsibilities are, go look for somebody. And we'll look for somebody that's done that before and that seems to be relatively successful in that role, and we'll slot them in. Okay,
yeah.
The minute we hire them, our productivity goes down because now we got to train this person. We don't know him or her. Takes a little while to get to know them. That is what, in a sense, reduces talent density. What Netflix basically discovered, and I just, by the way, talked to the head of HR at OpenAI yesterday about this. is they said, look, that's not good enough. Every person, and Netflix has about, I don't know, 14, 15,000 people. It's not a super big company. But what they say is every additional hire must improve the productivity of everybody else, not just them. So if they're not bringing value add skills, challenging the norms, new innovatives, ideas that we don't have already, increasing the productivity of others, we don't want to just hire somebody to fill the slot. We want it to continually increase density. Now, you know, as the density goes up, of course, things fall out. People are sometimes in roles where they're not super successful. But the mathematical modeling of a dense talent company is called a power law, or it's the 80-20 rule. The 80-20 rule, or what's also called a Pareto distribution, it's a different kind of mathematical distribution, basically says that if you really look around in most organizations, 20% of the people do 80% of the work.
Right.
And the implicate, and you know, everybody knows this is sort of true, is that every now and then you find yourself in a role where you are just so good at it, you're a superstar. And this happens to many, many people. Actually, sort of happens to everybody over time. And if you can find people and put them into roles where they can become what I call hyper performers, you can keep the talent density high. In order to do that, you have to allow people to move around. You have to give people feedback so they know when they're not successful in a job that you have high expectations for them. You have to give them opportunities to grow and development. And you have to have a mindset that people can reinvent themselves in different roles. And don't assume that the mathematician over in the finance department could never work in IT and cybersecurity, because actually he or she might be the perfect fit for this other job, and they might actually be better at that than they were at doing, you know, bookkeeping. So there's a lot of different ways of thinking about organizations. The reason that I think it's important now is we're not going to have any choice. I mean, the job market's going to get more and more competitive. And if you want to just lop off 10% at the bottom all the time and sort of continue this mediocrity type of performance management, you're going to be disrupted by a competitor that's just got better people. And by the way, I think this is a lot of the reasons mergers and acquisitions happen is sometimes the core company becomes more sort of less dense, and then you buy a company that's really expert at something just to get the talent. You bring them in, you apply the management practices of the big company to the small company, and 5 years later, all those people have left.
Yeah, totally.
So I think this is a really important concept for people to really just start thinking about.
Yeah, I love this concept so much. You nailed it. I mean, our performance management practices cater to mediocrity, right? It basically says we want to be mediocre, and it causes a lot of gaming, right? Because people then will wait until a certain time in the performance cycle to eliminate to performance manage people. It just leads to all sorts of behaviors that are just not conducive to excellence at a company. So I really like this concept, and I'll continue following what you have to say on this one.
And when you talk to companies that have this philosophy, the employees are incredibly energized and engaged and excited. Yeah. And they know there's a lot of accountability and feedback, but they like that. So you end up attract the kind of people that want to be there anyway. So there's a lot of multiple effects in different dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds great. So let's pivot and talk about transform for a moment to feed my FOMO. Okay. So what were some of the insights that you gleaned over the course of the few days at Transform? Were there any aha moments that you walked away with?
I think that the theme of the conference is to do things, to talk about innovations and breakthroughs and creative ideas. And there was a ton of that going on. And there were a lot of smaller, newer vendors in different areas of well-being, mental health. You know, the thing that I walked away, I mean, it's a little bit wacky because I'm a little bit older, but I think the thing that I walked away with is this is the workforce. This is what people want. And we've got to keep being creative about what we offer to employees in the workplace to accommodate the needs that they have, you know, to be productive.
Thanks for listening to Foresight. If you enjoyed the episode, we would love to hear from you. Leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Your ratings and reviews also help more people like you find our show so that we can reach more future forward leaders and achieve our mission of making work better.
Follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn at Future Forward, and sign up for our weekly newsletter, Foresight, on our website, futureforward.com. That's FutureForward.com, where we share even more about the new world of work. Talk to you next week.